Welcome to Hour One of the Arizona Republic for October 7th. I'm your volunteer reader, Jack Palmer. In this hour, we'll be reading headlines, Valiant State, and USA Today headlines. Our first article is titled, Condor's Release Draws Big Crowd, written by John Leos. One brave condor was greeted by sunny skies and a cheering crowd September 27th after spreading its wings and taking its first flight over Vermilion Cliffs National Monument. Meanwhile, four less adventurous condors spent the weekend gathering their courage before making the big leap on Monday, September 29th. The five critically endangered California condors were scheduled for release during an annual event organized by the Peregrine Fund, a nonprofit organization that manages Arizona's condor population in coordination with federal and state partners. This is their final destination, and it's a remarkable celebration in time when we can increase the population through a pretty impressive captive breeding program, said Tim Hauk, the Peregrine Fund's California Condor Program Director. It gives us a lot of hope, said Hauk. The event coincided with the National Public Lands Day, the nation's largest single-day volunteer event for public lands, which draws about 600 people. In what is described as a soft release, wildlife biologists open the pen at the top of the cliffs and allow the condors to fly out of captivity when they're ready. While one condor flew out after about 20 minutes, the other four waited until the start of the week before joining the wild flock, bringing the total number of endangered California condors in the Arizona-Utah flock to 88. Different birds have different confidence levels, said Hauk. We don't want to release birds under conditions where they're under undue stress. We want this to be as smooth a transition as possible. Some years it's quick, some years it takes a couple of days. This year's group of adolescent condors were hatched and raised as part of a captive breeding program at the Oregon Zoo and the San Diego Zoo Safari Park. With a wingspan of almost 10 feet and weighing up to 25 pounds, the California condor is the largest land bird in North America. Though the ancient species once soared over most of the continent, by the mid-20th century, the population of condors had dramatically declined due to habitat degradation, lead poisoning, shooting, and the use of DDT pesticide. Lawmakers listed California condors among the first species to gain federal protection in the Endangered Species Preservation Act of 1966, a predecessor to the modern-day Endangered Species Act. But by 1982, the population of condors had declined to only 22 individual birds. In response, wildlife managers made the difficult decision to bring every wild bird into captivity and begin a captive breeding program. Since then, the program has evolved into a multifaceted recovery effort spanning three states and two countries. The program, led by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, now includes state wildlife management agencies in Arizona, Utah, and California, multiple zoos and nonprofit partners, as well as the Yurok tribe in Northern California. Today, there are five free-flying populations of California condors, three in California, one in Mexico, and one along the Arizona-Utah border. In 2024, U.S. Fish and Wildlife reported 396 individuals in the wild. Because California condors can typically only produce one offspring every 2 years, the recovery of the species has been slow. This year marks the second release of endangered condors in Arizona since the outbreak of avian flu killed 20% of the Arizona-Utah flock in 2023. The five condors released this year, along with the 24 birds released in 2024, have increased both the population on the landscape and the genetic diversity of the flock. As wildlife biologists celebrated the latest group of endangered birds to fly free, the majestic species continues to face major threats to recovery. This summer, two wildfires burning near the Grand Canyon threatened Arizona's flock of condors. The Dragon Brava fire and the White Sage fire collectively burned over 200,000 acres on the Kaibab Plateau, including areas where California condors have been known to roost. During the day, the condors are capable of traveling long distances, allowing them to steer clear of the burning forests. But when wildfires spread quickly, nesting condors and chicks incapable of flight are left vulnerable. In 2020, the Dolan Fire in Central California killed 12 endangered condors, including two chicks, that were roosting near Big Sur. The fire also consumed an 80-acre condor sanctuary operated by the Ventana Wildlife Society. The majority of the condors are equipped with GPS trackers, which allow the wildlife biologists to monitor their locations and potential risks to their survival. Though no condors were roosting near the Grand Canyon area wildfires, the Peregrine Fund evacuated three captive condors in their facilities to a safer location. Most of the condors take up residence in the Utah high country during the summer where there is ample food, so overall impact on their normal activity was minimal, said Hauck in a news release. There also didn't happen to be any active nest locations near the fire, which would have posed a risk to young birds that cannot yet fly. The Grand Canyon fires may end up helping the flock, according to Hauck, because condors prefer open landscapes where food can be easily spotted as opposed to thick forests. But the closure of the North Rim and reduced traffic in the region has also reduced the amount of roadkill for the birds to scavenge. Wildlife managers say this may cause the condors to travel to unexpected locations in search of food. By far, the greatest threat to California condors in the United States is lead poisoning caused by bullet fragments embedded in dead animals. When hunters use lead-based ammo, which is often cheaper and more easily accessible than non-lead options, the condors can ingest the bullet fragments that remain in the carcasses and gut piles left behind. Condors are obligate scavengers, meaning they will only eat animals that are already dead. The highly social birds also eat in groups, meaning that a single lead-filled animal carcass can contaminate multiple condors at one time. Wildlife biologists can treat lead poisoning if the condors are captured in time, but the problem continues to plague the endangered condors and limits their recovery. Between 1992 and 2024, lead poisoning killed 151 condors in the wild, almost 50% of all deaths with a known cause, according to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. In the Arizona-Utah population, about 60 condors have died from lead poisoning since the birds were introduced to the region in 1996. The Arizona Game and Fish Department runs a lead reduction program that provides free non-lead ammunition to hunters who draw tags in areas with condors. This year's hunters are very engaged in this conservation program and have been requesting lead-free ammo for their upcoming hunts, said Aaron Brown, lead reduction program coordinator for Arizona Game and Fish, in a news release. Having hunters on board is so essential because lead poisoning is population limiting for these birds and one of the main challenges to reaching a self-sustaining population. The next article is titled, Shutdown Has Effect on Social Services, written by Laura Gersoni. The ongoing government shutdown is expected to have acute impacts in Arizona, but some services will be hit harder than others. Many Arizonans depend on federal money in the form of Social Security benefits, nutrition assistance, veteran services, Medicare and Medicaid, and more. Another 60,000 workers in the state depend on the federal government for their salaries. Government services operate on a limited basis in a shutdown and can have unexpected consequences the longer the standoff goes on. In general, federal agencies will scale back their work, though many benefits will continue to flow. Social Security payments will go out as usual during the shutdown, but other services provided by that agency could be disrupted. The agency will keep processing applications for benefits, requests for appeals, and actions that might impact payment, such as changes in address, according to a contingency planning memo. But it will temporarily stop verifying benefits, processing overpayments, and doing other administrative work such as processing Freedom of Information Act requests. Health insurance benefits through Medicaid and Medicare will keep flowing too, though the result of the shutdown could affect the program in the longer term. Democrats are insisting that a funding deal extend ACA tax credits that could spike Americans' health insurance premiums if they sunset as scheduled in December. And they've continued to criticize the GOP-led cuts to Medicaid as part of the Trump-backed Big Beautiful Bill earlier this year. Republicans, on the other hand, continued to advocate for a clean plan that continues government funding at previous levels. Trump's economic team has estimated that those receiving aid from SNAP, the program formerly known as food stamps, could begin seeing disruptions about a month into the shutdown. The White House estimates that there are around 887,000 total SNAP enrollees in Arizona. WIC, the federal nutrition program supporting women, infants, and children, could see holdups even sooner. Benefits are flowing as usual for the time being, but they are projected to run dry in 1 to 2 weeks, according to the National WIC Association. Until then, WIC will continue operating under available funding, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture contingency plan. It'll be difficult for state or local governments to backfill the costs of the program. Navajo County is bracing for impact, Assistant County Manager Rochelle LaCapa said. The funding supports around 153,000 clients in Arizona, according to the White House. If the shutdown lasts for longer than 1 to 2 weeks, a significant proportion of our families who qualify for WIC will be impacted, LaCapa said. The Department of Veterans Affairs will scale back its operations, but most benefits and services will still be delivered. VA medical centers, outpatient clinics, and vet centers will remain open, according to the department. Veterans' benefits will keep being processed and delivered including for pension, education, housing, and other compensation. But some of its call centers will be closed, as will VA Benefits regional offices. The agency will temporarily halt its transition programs and career counseling services. Services such as passport applications to the State Department, loan applications to the Small Business Administration, and government inspections from the Food and Drug Administration may be suspended. The Postal Service typically continues its operations as usual. National parks may be closed too. Even if Arizona and other states temporarily oversee Grand Canyon National Park, for example, services such as maintenance and trash collection may be suspended during a shutdown. The next article is titled, Illinois Joins Legal Battle Against Deploying Guard, written by Sudeeksha Kochi and Swapna Venugopal Ramaswamy. A third state on October 6th joined a legal fight to attempt to prevent President Donald Trump from sending National Guard troops to Democrat-run cities. Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul filed a lawsuit that challenges the Trump administration's unlawful deployment of National Guard members in Illinois to perform federal law enforcement functions, according to a news release. Trump has announced he is sending 300 Illinois National Guard troops to Chicago, which joined in the suit. Raoul argues that the deployment exceeds the administration's authority and that Trump has not met the legal requirements to justify it. A president can only deploy those troops under the following specific limited circumstances: invasion, rebellion, or if the federal government is unable to enforce federal laws, Raoul said. California and Oregon were already in court fighting Trump's deployment of National Guard troops to Portland. On October 4th, U.S. District Judge Karen Imigut ruled that Trump could not deploy Oregon National Guard troops to the state's largest city. Then the Pentagon said it had reassigned 200 California National Guard members to Portland. On October 5th, Imigut temporarily blocked that move as well. How could bringing in federalized National Guard from California not be in direct contravention of the decision I issued yesterday? Imigut, a Trump appointee, asked a Trump administration lawyer during a hearing. The judge said there was no evidence that recent protests necessitated the presence of National Guard troops. Earlier on October 5th, California Governor Gavin Newsom said he was suing Trump over the order to deploy the California National Guard to Oregon. After a federal court blocked his attempt to federalize the Oregon National Guard, Donald Trump is deploying 300 California National Guard personnel into Oregon. They are on their way now, Newsom wrote on X, adding, "We are taking this fight back to court." Oregon Attorney General Dan Rayfield announced an amended lawsuit on October 5th that added California as a party to its suit. Imigut's ruling, which will remain in effect until at least October 19th, means the Trump administration would be blocked from sending any National Guard troops to Portland while Oregon and California seek a longer-term ruling in court. President Trump exercised his lawful authority to protect federal assets and personnel in Portland following violent riots and attacks on law enforcement, White House spokesperson Abigail Jackson told USA Today. Lawyers from the Oregon Attorney General's office told federal officials the Portland protests were small and sedate, resulting in only 25 arrests in mid-June and no arrests since June 19th. The next article is entitled, "Governor Tours Globe After Deadly Flooding," written by Ray Covarrubias. Governor Katie Hobbs visited the damage left behind from deadly flooding that swept through the Globe area on September 26th. On October 4th, Hobbs arrived by a plane landing near the Gia County Fairgrounds, about 10 minutes west of downtown Globe. "We knew the rains were coming," Hobbs said. "I don't think anyone expected it to be at the level it was, or the devastation was." She described her visit to Globe as an opportunity to look ahead and focus on flood mitigation strategies that could prevent similar destruction in the future. Her visit coincided with an announcement from the Arizona Department of Forestry and Fire Management that recovery efforts would be handed off to local officials on October 5th. Over the course of the week-long cleanup, crews recovered 66 vehicles and 800 propane tanks that had been swept away, according to the Department of Forestry and Fire Management. In addition, 288 tons of green waste and other debris had been cleared from yards, washes, and roads. Almost 8,000 cubic yards of dirt was removed as well. State support for recovery efforts would continue to be available if needed, said Tiffany DeVia, a spokesperson for the Forestry Department. At the fairgrounds, Hobbs saw a warehouse converted into a one-stop shop for residents in need, home to a disaster resistance center established for the community. Gabe Levine, director of the Arizona Division of Emergency Management, led Hobbs through much of the tour at the fairgrounds. Hobbs asked questions throughout, including about staff, resources, and the many people affected by the floods. Edgar Olivo, CEO of the Red Cross Arizona and New Mexico region, said about 50 residents of the area had lost everything. Near Broad and Mesquite streets in Globe, Hobbs was led by Mayor Al Gameros on a walking tour of the downtown area, where many of the streets and businesses were still in recovery mode. Of the many businesses impacted, Hobbs met briefly with the owners of Kino Floors and Interior, La Casita Cafe, and the Globe Antique Mall, all located within feet of one another on Broad Street. Hobbs noted that her office had been hearing from many in the community who didn't have flood insurance due to its high cost. Gameros introduced Hobbs to downtown business owners whose properties were seriously damaged. "This is an area that is really bad," he told Hobbs. Hobbs asked the mayor questions about the disaster recovery throughout. At the antique mall, owner Roger Dalling showed Hobbs where over 4 feet of floodwater had submerged his store, destroying collectibles, vinyl records, books, and porcelain. "We need money now," said Dalling, holding back tears not long after he spoke to the governor. La Casita Cafe, meanwhile, had already begun repairs. Owner Annie Villalobos proudly showed off new siding and invited the governor to return. "We were one of the hardest hit," Villalobos told Hobbs. "You'll have to come back and have lunch." Dale Fletcher, owner of Kino Floors, said floodwaters decimated his business. Hobbs said that federal money was needed to recover from the flooding. "We definitely need federal support for funding for projects," Hobbs said, But we need to put all options on the table to make sure communities like this don't have this level of devastation. Senator Ruben Gallego, Democrat of Arizona, visited Globe on October 2nd and called for action to prevent such flooding in the future. Hobbs said she signed a letter requesting low-interest loans for affected residents through the U.S. Small Business Administration. Hobbs said she did not believe the shutdown of the federal government would impact recovery efforts, noting that crews from the Federal Emergency Management Agency had been on scene since September 29th. Before her roughly three-hour trip concluded, Hobbs held a closed-door meeting with local officials at the Gila County facility west of downtown Globe. Gameros told the Arizona Republic that the death toll as a result of the floods remained at three. He said two of the victims died in Globe and one died in Miami. Above all, Gameros said, more money was needed to help Globe recover. What we need right now is cash, Gameros said. Our residents and businesses didn't have flood insurance. Gamero said there needed to be a push from all sides to accelerate that funding. He noted that some in downtown Globe could face more hardship. We don't yet know the full impact on our economy, but some of these buildings downtown may need to be condemned, he said. That really hurts. But with the assistance from leaders at all levels of government, Gamero said he saw the future of the Globe community as prosperous. There's hope, he said. We're going to rebuild, and we're going to rebuild better. The next article is entitled, Trump Urges Virginia Attorney General Candidate to Drop Out, written by Swapni Venugopal Ramaswamy. President Donald Trump called on Democratic Virginia Attorney General candidate Jay Jones to drop out of the race after reported texts by Jones in 2022 suggested the former Virginia House Speaker should receive two bullets to the head were made public. It has just come out that the radical left lunatic who is running against Jason Mayeras, the great attorney general in Virginia, made sick and demented jokes, if they were jokes at all, which were not funny, Trump wrote on Truth Social on October 5th. Even Democrats are saying it is resignation from campaign territory. Trump added that Jones should drop out of the race immediately and endorsed Virginia Attorney General Jason Mayeras in the process. Republican House Delegate Carrie Coyner shared reported screenshots of her August 8, 2022 conversation with Jones, in which he admitted they had sent to her in error. In an email to the Progress Index, part of the USA Today network, Coyner called the messages not just disturbing, but disqualifying for anyone who seeks public office. Jay Jones wished violence on the children of a colleague and joked about shooting former Speaker Todd Gilbert. It's disgusting and unbecoming of any public official, Coyner said in a statement. The messages, first reported by conservative-leaning media outlet National Review, came after a poll conducted in the days following the conservative activist Charlie Kirk's assassination that found most Americans believe brash political rhetoric is contributing to violence. Other plots and threats have targeted Democrats, including a house fire set at Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro's house, a kidnapping plot against Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, and a man who broke into the home of former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to attack her husband with a hammer. According to the screenshots of the text, Jones was apparently upset by comments attributed to Gilbert on the death of a Democratic delegate. Jones accused the delegate of leaking information about Virginia House Democrats to the House Republican caucus. He initially apologized to Koyner for sending the message to her in error, but then launched into a rant where he compared Gilbert to former world dictators Adolf Hitler and Pol Pot. He reportedly mentioned how he would have loved to shoot all three of them. "Three people, two bullets. Gilbert, Hitler, and Pol Pot," he texted. "Gilbert gets two bullets to the head." Jones acknowledged in a statement from his campaign that, "like all people, I've sent text messages that I regret." He reiterated that violent rhetoric has no place in our politics. He accused Republican incumbent Jason Mayares of dropping smears through a media outlet favorable to Trump and Republicans. Democratic gubernatorial candidate Abigail Spanberger released a statement saying she spoke frankly with Jones about the messages. "After learning of these comments earlier today, I spoke frankly with Jay about my disgust with what he had said and texted," she said. "I made clear to Jay that he must fully take responsibility for his words. What I have also made clear is that as a candidate and as the next governor of our Commonwealth, I will always condemn violent language in our politics." You're listening to Hour One of today's Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Jack Palmer, and we'll continue with an article titled, "Talks Begin on Trump Plan to End Gaza War," written by Ahmed Fahmy, Nidal Al-Mughrabi, and Andrew Mills. Delegations from Israel and Hamas began indirect negotiations in Egypt on October 6th that the United States hopes will bring a halt to the war in Gaza. The negotiators are facing contentious issues, such as demands for Israel to pull out of the enclave and for Hamas to disarm. Israel and Hamas have both endorsed the overall principles behind President Donald Trump's plan, under which fighting would cease, hostages go free, and aid pour into Gaza. The plan also has the backing of Arab and Western states. Trump has called for negotiations to take place swiftly toward a final deal, in what Washington hails as the closest the sides have yet come to ending the fighting. "I'm told that the first phase should be completed this week, and I am asking everyone to move fast," Trump said in a social media post. But both sides are seeking clarification of crucial details, including over issues that have wrecked all previous attempts to end the war and could defy any quick resolution. Trump has told Israel to suspend its bombing of Gaza for the talks. Gaza residents said Israel had scaled back its offensive substantially, although it had not halted it altogether. Gaza health authorities reported 19 people killed by Israeli strikes in the past 24 hours, around a third of the typical daily toll of recent weeks, as Israel has been mounting one of its biggest offensives of the war, an all-out assault on Gaza City. Egyptian state TV reported that the talks had begun at the Red Sea resort of Sharm el-Sheikh. The talks commenced on the eve of the second anniversary of the Hamas attack on Israel that triggered the war, when fighters killed 1,200 people and took 251 hostages, the deadliest days for Jews since the Holocaust. Israel's retaliatory military campaign has killed more than 67,000 Palestinians and left a majority of 2.2 million Gazans homeless and hungry in the rubble of the enclave destroyed by relentless bombardment. Egyptian sources said Hamas was seeking clarification of several details, including guarantees that Israel would follow through with promises to withdraw its troops from Gaza once the militants give up their leverage by freeing their hostages. With Israeli forces blasting their way through Gaza City and flattening neighborhoods as they advance, Gaza residents say a ceasefire now is their last hope that the enclave will emerge habitable. If there is a deal, then we survive. If there isn't, it is like we have been sentenced to death, said Ghuram Mohammed, 20 years old, displaced along with her family in central Gaza. Inside Israel, there is a clamor for an end to the war to bring home hostages, although right-wing members of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's cabinet oppose any halt to fighting. Though Trump says he wants a deal quickly, an official briefed on the negotiations, speaking on condition of anonymity, said he expected the round of talks kicking off October 6th would require at least several days. The next article is entitled, New French Government Collapses After 14 Hours, written by Elizabeth Pino, Michael Rose, and Ingrid Mellander. France's new Prime Minister Sébastien Lecornu and his government resigned on October 6th, hours after Lecornu announced his cabinet lineup, making it the shortest-lived administration in modern French history and deepening the country's political crisis. The unexpected resignation came after allies and foes alike threatened to topple the new government, with Lecornu saying that meant he could not do his job. The announcement drove stocks and the euro sharply lower. Opposition parties immediately urged President Emmanuel Macron to resign or call a snap parliamentary election, saying there was no other way out of the crisis. Lecornu, who was Macron's fifth prime minister in 2 years, stayed in the job for only 27 days. His government lasted just 14 hours, highlighting divisions in the French parliament as the Eurozone's second largest economy struggles to put its finances in order. French politics have been increasingly unstable since Macron's re-election in 2022 for want of any party or grouping holding a parliamentary majority. Macron's decision to call a snap parliamentary election last year deepened the crisis by producing an even more fragmented parliament. The centrist president could now call new snap elections, resign, or try to appoint yet another prime minister who could be a politician or a technocrat. In past months, Macron, whose mandate runs until May 2027, has repeatedly ruled out stepping down or calling elections. He has yet to react publicly to Lecornu's resignation. In the opposition, many rushed to ask for Macron to call new snap parliamentary elections or quit. This joke has gone on long enough, and the farce must end, said far-right National Rally leader Marine Le Pen. Mathilde Pinault, of the hard-left France Unbowed, said, "The countdown has begun. Macron must go." David Lisnard, one of the conservative Republicans, was also among those calling for Macron to leave. The Republicans' party chief, Bruno Retailleau, the outgoing interior minister, whose tweets lashing out at the cabinet lineup October 5th was key in the latest crisis, was more cautious, saying the ball was in Macron's camp and he must speak soon. If there is a deadlock, then we will have to return to the voting booth. But I think there are other ways before it comes to that, he told TF1 TV. To explain why he could not go forward and strike compromises with rival parties, Le Cornu blamed the egos of opposition politicians who rigidly stuck to their manifestos, while those inside his minority coalition were focusing on their own presidential ambitions. Retailleau is thought to be considering a bid for president. On the streets of Paris, many were shocked at the worsening instability. "I've never seen this," said 79-year-old pensioner Gerard Desiteau. "I'm almost ashamed, even, to be French." Some said fresh elections seemed like the only option. "We cannot continue like this," said 20-year-old political science student Marius Loyer. After weeks of consultations with political parties across the board, Le Cornu, a close ally of Macron, had appointed his first ministers October 5th, and they had been set to hold their first meeting the next day. But the new cabinet lineup had angered opponents and allies alike, who found it too right-wing, or not sufficiently so, raising questions on how long it could last. Le Cornu handed his resignation to Macron, who accepted it. If you miss any of these articles, you can always listen on demand by going to our website, sunsounds.org, click on Broadcast Info and Audio, and then On Demand. We'll continue with an article titled, "Court to Weigh LGBTQ Plus Conversion," written by Maureen Gropey. Growing up in a conservative religious family in Arizona, Matt Salmon was desperate not to be gay. He prayed, fasted, read scripture, and pleaded with God to change him. Even at other kids' birthday parties, when they were blowing out their birthday candles, "I would try to make my wish before they could, to try to steal it," Salmon, now 37 years old, recounted. When that didn't work, he agreed at age 18 to see a counselor he was told could help. Not only did his attraction to men not go away, but Salmon said he absorbed the therapist's message that something was deeply wrong with him. Although he's worked hard to undo those 2 years of what he called psychological abuse, Salmon says he still feels so hurt to this day and broken by the experience. So he was stunned when the Supreme Court said it would decide whether Colorado's ban on conversion therapy for LGBTQ plus minors violates the counselor's free speech rights. "Licensed professionals don't have free speech," said Salmon, now a psychiatrist and counselor himself in Washington, D.C. "You don't just get to say whatever you want." In one of the biggest cases of the term, the justices will debate October 7th whether the First Amendment allows states to regulate treatments like talk therapy. Kaylee Chiles, the licensed counselor challenging Colorado's ban, said the law is preventing her from communicating messages that some people, including those who believe they were born in the wrong body, are interested in. The law, she said, allows her to support adolescents who want to transition to another gender, but not to help them accept their assigned sex at birth. Clients would like to hear a message of hope that you can have struggles with your body in a variety of ways, and you can actually grow in peace and comfort with the body that you're in, Child said. She views her work as an outgrowth of her Christian faith. Childs has the backing of the Trump administration. The Justice Department has told the Supreme Court that Colorado is muzzling one side of an ongoing debate in the mental health community about how to discuss questions of gender and sexuality with children. Colorado argues that states have long had the ability to protect patients by regulating health care, and the evidence is clear that trying to change someone's sexual orientation or gender identity doesn't work and can lead to depression, anxiety, and suicide. So-called conversion therapies are an inhuman and abusive practice overwhelmingly shown to harm young people, Colorado Attorney General Phil Weiser said. We have a compelling interest in protecting children from this dangerous pseudoscience. Childs can use a variety of therapeutic techniques to help minors, including those who don't want to act on same-sex attractions, the state says. But counselors can't seek the predetermined outcome of changing a minor's sexual orientation or gender identity. Having same or multi-gender attractions, behaviors, and desires, as well as transgender, non-binary, and gender-diverse identities and expressions, is a healthy feature found in every society and culture, a coalition of major medical and psychological professional associations told the Supreme Court in a brief supporting California law. Still, in 2023, the Trevor Project, an advocacy group for LGBTQ plus people, said it found more than 600 professional counselors and hundreds more unlicensed counselors who say they can help alter someone's sexual orientation or gender identity. There's a myth out there that conversion therapy is an artifact of history, said Casey Pick, Senior Director of Law and Policy at the Trevor Project. Historically, there were a wide range of inventions. Those included adverse techniques, such as using bad smells, electric shocks, or other negative feedback to try to train the patient to not have homosexual thoughts. Today, talk therapy is most common, according to the Williams Institute at the UCLA School of Law, a think tank that researches sexual orientation and gender identity issues. Salmon said his counselor suggested his attraction to men was his father's fault because his job kept him away from home a lot, causing Salmon to identify more with his mother. He convinced me that my parents were part of the problem, Salmon said. He put a wedge between us. More than 20 states have restricted the practice through laws, including some that were backed by Republican governors. A handful of other states have issued executive orders or regulatory agencies to attack the issue. In 2015, a division of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services made a case for eliminating the use of conversion therapy among youth. There is limited research on conversion therapy efforts among children and adolescents. However, none of the existing research supports the premise that mental or behavioral health interventions can alter gender identity or sexual orientation, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration said in its report. Childs argues that issues related to sex and sexuality are not as settled as Colorado claims. Her attorney, Jim Campbell, said Colorado is pointing to studies that lump together the kind of counseling Childs wants to do with aversive treatments used in the past. Childs is simply practicing speech-only counseling, said Campbell, chief legal counsel with Alliance Defending Freedom, a conservative legal organization. If you go through the seminal American Psychological Association report that they have included, it says over and over again that there is no evidence that this kind of counseling causes harm, he said. In a brief supporting Colorado's law, the APA says Childs is mischaracterizing key aspects of the association's 2009 report on conversion therapy that found it is ineffective and can be harmful. Our finding in 2009 and subsequently in 2021 is that these sexual orientation and gender identity change efforts have no track record of being effective, said Deanne Ottaviano, the APA's general counsel. But they do have a good record based on self-reported evidence of causing harm, depression and suicidality and loneliness and other adverse psychological concerns. The next article is entitled, U.S. Lawmakers Playing the Blame Game, written by Susan Page. And on the fifth day, nobody rested. Not that Washington was consumed on October 5th with trying to reopen the federal government. The Sunday airwaves were afire instead with efforts to assign the blame. While budget showdowns have headed off this fiscal cliff before, this current version is a nuclear war of shutdowns, with more explosive impact on the government and more intense incentives to keep it going. House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries of New York called President Donald Trump's tactics during the showdown outrageous and unhinged. The American people deserve better than lies, than attacks, than deep fake videos, and the president spending all of his time on the golf course, he said on NBC's Meet the Press. We need serious leadership. But House Speaker Mike Johnson replied that Democrats were responsible for empowering the administration to cut federal jobs and freeze grants. In a situation like this, where the Senate Democrats have decided to turn the keys to the kingdom over to the White House, they have to make tough decisions, the Louisiana Republican told NBC. He said Russell Vogt, director of the Office of Management and Budget, now has to determine what are essential programs, policies, and personnel. That's not a job that he relishes, but he's being required to do it by Chuck Schumer. Neither side sounded like compromise was in the air. Indeed, Johnson has recessed the House for the week. In the past half century, every president except George W. Bush and Joe Biden have weathered shutdowns of at least a few days. During their tenures, Bill Clinton, Jimmy Carter, and Barack Obama all saw shutdowns of more than 2 weeks. The 35-day record was set during Trump's first term. The shutdown ended when he folded on demands for more funds to build a wall along the southern border. The current shutdown isn't nearly the longest, at least not yet, but it's already scoring the most far-reaching substantive impact of any of them. In the sweeping efforts during his second term to expand the powers of the presidency, Trump has seized the opportunity of the shutdown to threaten layoffs of federal workers and freeze billions of dollars in federal grants to predominantly Democratic states. I can't believe the radical left Democrats gave me this unprecedented opportunity, the president crowed on social media. That might help explain why Trump hasn't rushed into extended talks with Democratic congressional leaders to negotiate a deal. Donald Trump is in the Presidential Witness Protection Program, Jeffries complained. No one can find him. As the shutdown loomed, Trump told reporters he might fire vast numbers of federal workers rather than simply furloughing them as in past shutdowns. He vowed to target Democrat things and Democrat agencies. Amid the shutdown's early days, his administration has frozen $18 billion in federal funding for major infrastructure projects in New York City, put on hold $2.1 billion in funding for Chicago transit projects, and cut nearly $8 billion in Energy Department grants in 16 states. All those states were carried by Democratic nominee Kamala Harris in the 2024 presidential election. For Democrats, too, some of the incentives today are to fight, not compromise. The party's core supporters have soured on their congressional leaders for failing to effectively stand up to Trump during the dizzying opening months of his second term, when he has claimed unprecedented authority to fire agency heads, push for investigations of his political enemies, and take from Congress traditional powers over spending. In an NPR Marist poll taken in late September, fewer than half of Democratic voters, or 48%, approved of the job congressional Democrats were doing. In contrast, 87% of Republicans approved of the job the congressional GOP was doing. What's more, Democratic voters are increasingly spoiling for a fight. 47% said it was more important for members of Congress to stand on principle, even if it meant a government shutdown. That's a sea change from polling before the 2013 shutdown, when Democrats by 4-1 backed compromise. And that's all the time we have for this hour of the Arizona Republic. I'm your broadcast volunteer, Jack Palmer. Stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona.